The advantage of water is that I'm watching a different medium. If you're dealing only with UFOs in the air, you're looking at an invisible thing to start with. Water has color and texture, and this all is visible when the UFO affects it. It's not visible in a regular atmosphere.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh. Loud sound that seemed to fight came back like a slow voice on a wave of fight. That was no DJ, that was hazy cosmic time.
Banal of America.
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 Woo!
Audio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with the return of BOA Audio Season 3. It is May 4th, 2008, and it is great to be back here with all new, fresh episodes of BOA Audio. Let me catch you up to date on a little bit of work we got done over the course of the spring break. I'm happy to report that we have finally fixed the podcast feed. We've taken it in-house. We had a little note up at BOA over the last week or so, but in case you missed that, here's the gist of it. New podcast feed, www.banalofamerica.com/podcast.xml. Grab that URL, punch it into your podcast receiving software or your iTunes, or simply go to iTunes and punch in Banal. We're working on getting the old podcast feed taken off of iTunes. For now, there's two of them on there. You'll know which one's BOA because it has the newest episodes posted, and it will have the BOA logo. Subscribe to that, and you're back to being hooked up to regular BOA audio episodes as they come rolling out. Now, onward into this week's program. It is a barn burner of an episode, my friends. It is definitely a must-hear episode for any serious student of ufology. The guest is Carl Feint of the fantastic website waterufo.net, a tremendous resource for all kinds of fascinating cases, exploring the connection between UFOs and water. So much stuff here that I had either never heard about or even thought about. Carl Feint is doing the research into that stuff. In this hour and change interview, we're going to be talking about why Carl decided to investigate this aspect of ufology, interesting trends and fascinating insights that he's gained from his research, cases that he does not think are related to UFOs, the international aspects of the phenomena, sea monsters, radar and sonar cases, UFOs versus USOs, water wheels, the El Tanin, Shag Harbor, and tons more aquatic-themed esoteric material. As Carl will point out in the beginning of the interview, with the exception of Ivan T. Sanderson and a handful of notes in other books, the water UFO connection has pretty much slipped under the radar of modern-day ufology, and there is so much there. It is amazing. And that is why we have Carl Feint here on the program. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Carl Feint, let me give you a little bit of background on him. Carl Feint has been fascinated by aviation since the late days of World War II. Starting with carved balsa replicas and later by flying models of aircraft, he followed his passion into service as a cadet in the Civil Air Patrol. After high school, he studied aircraft engineering at the Academy of Aeronautics in New York City. Following 2 years with the Air Force, a family hardship forced him to return to civilian life, where he joined a major airline, for which he worked in customer service for 34 years. Upon retirement, he was interested in becoming active in ufology, about which he had been reading since the early 1960s. The opportunity came when Jan Aldrich, a UFO researcher, asked for volunteers to do local newspaper searches. Over the course of 8 years, he studied microfilm rolls at the University of Delaware, exhaustively covering the years between 1923 and 1967. He found approximately 750 UFO-related articles, this from the second smallest state in the Union. Intrigued by the fact that aircraft cannot emerge nor submerge into water, he started assembling water-related UFO cases, which have grown into a database of this aspect of the UFO mystery. His website is www.waterufo.net. Definitely want to check this website out. You're going to be sitting there for hours just looking through these water-related UFO cases. Tremendous stuff. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on April 21st, 2008. Carl Feint, talking about the water UFO connection on BOA Audio Season 3. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Banal of America Audio. My guest is Carl Feint. He is a specialist in the UFO realm, studying the water UFO connection. You can find his website at waterufo.net. He's done just an amazing amount of work compiling and putting together these cases of UFOs related to water and really trying to come to some kind of conclusion about them and digging out a lot of fascinating details about the water UFO connection, or as some people like to call them, the USOs. I had the opportunity to meet him and interview him at the Mass Monster Mash / Mass UFO show back in October, and already there was a tremendous amount of buzz on just our little 15-minute interview, so I'm really looking forward to sitting down with him here today to talk in depth about the USO phenomenon and the water UFO connection. So, Carl, welcome to Banal of America Audio. It's great to have you back here on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start on, I guess, with the bio, the background. You know, who is Carl Feint, and how did you get interested in the UFO phenomenon?
Well, I've been interested in aviation since I was knee-high to a grasshopper type. I love aircraft, and, of course, UFOs are some kind of aircraft. And the water angle came on much later, 60s, I started reading about UFOs. And occasionally in a book, you'd run across one case that talked about water. And I said, this is unbelievable. An aircraft goes into the water, it's going to break up, sink, and everything else. These things are popping in and out of water left and right. And I just couldn't get over the fact that nobody was, jumping up and down about it. So finally in 70, Sanderson wrote a book about it, but it was more on the idea of a civilization living under the water rather than how it does get into and out of water. So when I retired, I figured, well, this is where I can pick up being active, and took it from there.
There you go. And like you said, it sounds like the USO thing kind of just came and went with Ivan T. Sanderson. Why do you think it seems like the USOs have kind of fallen between the cracks of the UFO field?
I really don't know. To me, of course, it's totally amazing. I took aeronautical engineering, as it says in the bio, but to me, you know, metal bends and, you know, you can rupture it and everything else. So to have a craft slam into the water and then pop out the other side somewhere is incredible to me. But evidently not too many people thought of it in that respect, and I can't imagine why, but it's becoming bigger now. They're doing more and more on the History Channel with, water UFOs and so forth. But the cases are far and in between, and I think that's probably the reason that it's kind of in the background.
Yeah. Let's talk about waterufo.net, because this website is amazing. I mean, I was diving into it all last night and tonight, no pun intended on the dive, but it's just tremendous. It's monstrous in depth. Where did you get all these different files of UFO, USO cases?
Well, as I said, my problem was the cases are spread out all over the place. They're in journals, books, newsletters, you name it, and it's like one case here, one case there. So Sanderson had 262 cases in his book, but and which I've used, as a matter of fact, but I went to the original reference. But I'm now up to 1,126 cases.
Wow.
Of course, I've also had a few. His book was in 1970, and this is 2008, so I've picked up cases between. But like I said, there's very few publications that had water in them. Lorenzen's book had a chapter of 10 pages. Flying Saucer Review used to have like a couple of articles every so often, UFOs from underseas, this, that, and the other thing. And so what I've been doing technically is scraping everything together, and my website has grown from nothing, about 100 cases, I think, or 200 cases, up to its present size, mainly because I keep picking them up here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah, I really got to give it to you. Just tremendous kudos on just the depth of the stuff on the website. I was just amazed by how many cases were there and just the amount of research that you've done on the USO phenomenon. It's just amazing.
Fortunately, I'm retired.
There you go. I'm sure that helps. And when we were talking before we did, when we were setting up the interview and stuff, you mentioned that something about Ted Phillips and the trace cases sort of piqued your interest about the water connection to the UFOs. Can you extrapolate on that whole thing?
Well, I'm a very big fan of Ted Phillips. I mean, we have too much sociology, psychology, philosophy, and ufology. And Ted's the only one who's digging in the ground to find out what the UFO does to the ground, does to the trees, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing he never tackled that I know of is water. And so I said to myself, well, Ted's not doing it, so I said, maybe I can put my paws in there and see what I can come up with. And it's been that way ever since. I met him at one of the MUFON conferences, as a matter of fact. I followed him. Tough act to follow, by the way. But I have a great deal of respect for him and what he does, and I was hoping that somehow water could reveal some of the thing. It has to me, anyway, what the UFO actually does.
Yeah, and you said that he didn't do the water element. Did you ever ask him, like, why that was the case, or did it even come up at all?
No, to tell you the truth, we didn't. We sat at the table talking about every other kind of thing, you know, cars being lifted, this, that, and the other thing, but we never got into my interest of the thing. Of course, I guess he was waiting to see what I had to say at the convention, symposium.
Yeah.
But we were having such a good time, we didn't even think of it.
Seems like most of the time the talk centers around non-UFO-related stuff anyway, so.
Yeah. No, as a matter of fact, he sent me an email once and congratulated me on my website. He had hit it looking for a particular case, and I had to tell him that it was a hoax, or at least we signed off as a hoax. But I really respect the man's efforts, and he spends a lot of money and time on this thing as well.
He's done some great work and stuff, and you're right there behind him with the stuff on USOs. I mean, it's tremendous. That website is it's awesome. It's a tool that should be used by so many researchers, and I have a feeling it is being picked up by so many people. On the page here on the website, let me look at it here. On the page, why is this site necessary? You say that that you hope to break down these sightings statistically. Have you gotten to that point yet where you're bringing out some hard numbers here as far as the USO sightings go?
Well, I was thinking about I wrote that probably the first day I put the website up. You know? I was looking for somebody to come and give me help, but I haven't. Statistics in this area are really poor, you know. When you're talking about the height of the craft above the water, everything's estimates and colors. I'd love to have a database to put this thing all through, but I really don't have that kind of a database. I have cases all in date order, and that other part that's right below where it says other topics of interest, that's basically my breaking these cases down on what I've found out about, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's the most important part right now to me, because when you group these cases together as to what they're doing, they make more and more sense, you know, as to how the craft is reacting with the water. Physical influence on water, that third one down on the right-hand side, that one is my bright bulb on my head. That thing woke me up in no short order. I couldn't sleep that night when I did that thing. It was something unbelievable. And that's all different groups. There's four groups, and each one has witnesses that see each of these type of within the group. But when you put them all together, it spells mama. It really comes up. It's a fantastic thing, and this made me a true believer in UFOs. I've been with UFOs, like I said, since the early 60s, but this one told me, yes, they are real. There's no question of it in my mind.
Well, there you go. Now, let's sort of start then, I guess, with that category, because I'm hoping to go down some of these categories and talk to you about some of them. But since that one seemed to have such a profound effect on you, let's talk about that one.
Okay.
Tell me what you've figured out here about the physical effects on water.
Okay, well, basically, the four groups, people see water being bulging up as the UFO comes up out of the water. I mean, they have no conception that a UFO is coming up. They just see this strange anomaly in the water, a mounding, a bubble-like thing. And then all of a sudden, the UFO pops up out of it. Then we go to the second category, and that's a depression in the water. The UFO is just about, say, equal with the water, and below it, there's a hole in the water or a depression. The fourth one is really only one case, but it's the right guy, right place scenario. The UFO is slightly higher yet and still close to the water, but now it's kind of the water is mounding up under it, like a mountain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the category four. And then category five is the biggest one. That's called the water spout. Now, that's water being sucked up to the UFO from the surface of the water. And four different groups, it drove me nuts. I was sitting down one night, I put up yet another water case, and the problem to me was I couldn't relate one case to the other. There was no connecting influence on this thing.
Yeah.
So I sat down, I was aeronautical engineering. I still got my drafting board, so I said, I'm going to make the drawing, I'm going to start from the lowest one, go up to the highest one, and see if there's anything that visually I can see, you know, joining the four groups together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I finished it, it's the field surrounding the UFO. It was like a light. I can't describe it because it was so spectacular in my head. I just couldn't sleep all night long. The rotation of the field describes everything the UFO is doing. The water bulging and making a kind of a bubble on the surface is when the UFO is under, it's pushing the water up and out. When the UFO is depressing the water, it's because the field is rotating down into the water and pushing the water away. So you're not, when you're looking at it, you don't see the field, you just see the UFO and a hole in the water.
Mm-hmm.
But the field is actually creating that hole. The mounding is when it's above the surface. The field is returning into the UFO from into the bottom, and what's doing is dragging the water with it, and it's kind of a suction because of the rapid motion of the field. And then, of course, the water spout is the final part of it. It's just that it's up higher, still got the suction or vortex under it, and it appears to be sucking water into the UFO. Which it isn't. That's a byproduct. It's like prop wash.
Yeah, and you have an excellent drawing here on that page at waterufo.net. When they go down to physical influences of a UFO on water, there's a tremendous graphic here kind of describing what you're saying. Kind of can think of it as a sideways eight being the field, mm-hmm. Rotating one side going clockwise, the other side going counterclockwise, and the middle being sort of like the center of the UFO. And that thus creates sort of a circular thing going on around the UFO, the field, if you will.
Yeah. That's the actual picture that I drew.
Oh, nice.
I scanned that and pasted it in there. So that's the actual picture that I drew.
Yeah. I highly recommend people check that out because that will really give them an idea of what we're trying to convey here. Now, as far as that's sort of like the physical effect on the water, have there been any sort of studies as far as – I guess you could say trace cases, if you will, on the water, you know, any ill effects that have become onto the water as a result of the UFO being in there.
Well, I have another paper that I haven't published yet on the web. I'm going to hold it off for the book. It's called Heat in Water UFOs, and there's heat in various categories, which, again, is on that home page under in the rain, in the snow, through the ice. All of those have to do with the field, which is extremely hot. And I think you're familiar with the Cache Landrum case.
Mm-hmm.
And needless to say, that melted the asphalt on the highway, and When Betty tried to get in back into the car, the handle of the car was so hot, she burned herself. She had to use a coat as an insulator. So needless to say, this field is extremely hot, and that's a trace. That's a trace. And it creates steam and water, causes bubbling. And all these are different traces that show that that field, that rotating field, is hot. Of course, now I'm also getting to the point where I get to UFO making ice, which is kind of difficult to describe. I have no pictures of it on the web right now. But I'm going to get into that as well.
Like literally going into the water and somehow creating an ice situation?
Well, not going into the water. That field that rotates around a UFO, they can reverse the field. I've proven that in the abduction cases. And they can also turn it off. Now, if they turn the field off, you've got the opposite situation. It's no longer hot. It's actually ice cold. And I believe it's due to something close to what a absolute zero.
Yeah.
You know, that's 459 degrees below zero.
Yeah.
And so any event, this cold mass of air is circulating over the water, and it can freeze water because of that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And then one of the big categories you have here, aircraft carriers and other large ships. It sounds like that's where you get a lot of the reports, probably because with some of these ships, you have so many people on board that you know, you get a lot of good sightings and corroborating reports and stuff like that. Would you say that's one of the more predominant areas of USO sightings?
Really not.
Wow.
I hate to destroy you, but the reason I put that up is because there were so many aircraft carriers coming in on various levels, sonar, radar, and then I only have one case where I was seen going into or coming out of the water, but I have a lot of big ships in there besides aircraft carriers. I've got a battleship in World War II that fired on UFOs, and a destroyer, too.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, that's the 1942 and the 1945 cases. But I put that in because I have another category called up close and personal.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of reports that don't actually alter water in any way, shape, or form, but it's ships on water, and they're seeing various things like the UFOs in the air.
Yeah.
And it does various things. It emanates heat and whatever have you. And you don't want to throw these reports away because they're good reports. So anyway, that's my kind of a not a trash can, but a holding cell, you might say, for reports that don't fit my water category. But by the same token, aircraft carriers are about the same thing, but they also have radar and sonar, and I like that, you know, because they are actually tracking things that in the air coming towards the carrier or underwater, you know, below the carrier. So I figured that would be a separate category. And I've gotten a couple of responses from that through my website.
What kind of cases do you have in that regard as far as USOs being picked up on sonar or radar?
Well, basically, it is they picked something up. I have ships that... in one particular case, there was a thing about an island. They thought they were navigating over an unknown island in the Pacific. And the problem was the island started moving and going down deep.
Whoa.
And they're picking this up on the sonar. And needless to say, islands don't do that. But they were en route to some other port, and while they were tracking, they said, well, we got this thing here, it's not on our chart, so we'll put it down. Well, needless to say, that's a true USO, that's an unidentified submerged object. But there's a lot of radar cases. There's one particular one, I can't think of it, which it is offhand, but there's one where a guy was talking about them picking it up on radar, and then watching it zoom down towards the water, well, of course, you lose radar contact at that point.
Yeah.
And then immediately sonar picked it up. And they said it was zigzagging down as it was going down. It was zigzagging underwater. So, I mean, some kind of control was on the craft as it manipulated underwater.
That's interesting. That's a true USO, I guess you could say, huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then another subject here that I found interesting, death in the water.
Oh, dead in the water. Yeah, that is very interesting.
Talk about some of these cases in the dead in the water section, and you make a great point here for future ufologists as to have the specimens analyzed.
Right. Well, there's only one case in all of those, probably 12, I guess. I don't know how many there actually are. But the main thing is only one case actually took the fish to a laboratory to be examined.
Mm-hmm.
And the conclusion was that it was a concussion type thing where it had ruptured organs. It might be true, but by the same token, I think it's the field, really. It's either electrocuting them or radiating the fish or something. But you don't have, in any of those cases, a means of death. And almost all those cases are fish. However, I should also point out there's ducks in one particular case, ducks and geese that were found dead floating in the water where a UFO had popped out of a pond. And another one with two dead professional divers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of interesting. The thing is, again, you have these people who don't associate the death of these things with the UFO. As a matter of fact, funny story, I was up at a convention in Nova Scotia with Chris Stile and Don Ledger.
Yep.
And Chris was doing a video in any event. At the very end, he's just about finished, and he says, oh, by the way, I just thought of it. He says, a week later, dead fish were found floating in Shag Harbor. This is the big Shag Harbor incident, by the way.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I said, Chris, when the hell are you going to tell me? You know, but people don't associate it. You know, it's just one of those, well, something happened after, you know. And that's what happens. They're dead. They don't come swimming to the shore by themselves, but they get washed up with the tide eventually.
Yeah, and it's the sort of thing that happens maybe a couple of days later or something like that, and people mm-hmm. don't make the connection.
You know, the thing is, that's, again, another trace. For some reason, the UFO is causing death, not to all the fish around it, but evidently the ones up close to it. Now, that, like, again, it could be electrocution, like lightning hits the water. And it doesn't kill all the fish in the ocean. It only kills those in the immediate vicinity of the lightning hit. And it dissipates as it goes out. So it's only the fish that are close. And I think that's what's happening is the fish that are close to the UFO are the ones dying, not the ones further out.
Yeah. And to stay on the subject of fish here, what about the section fish reactions to a USO?
Well, that was another thing that kind of overlooked. I got help from Miss Joan Woodward. She did a fantastic job on animal reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I had asked her some questions, and then she helped me out with that in there. The thing is, again, you have people are amazed by the UFO. They're not looking in the water to see what the fish are doing. They're looking at the UFO for the most part. But in some cases, people did notice things about the fish. And I had one particular case, no, it's not in this one, as a matter of fact. It's not in this one because it had other features, and it's not in this category. But the guy goes underwater, he sees a UFO turn itself off, and he sees it glowing underwater, and then he sees it go black. So he swims down towards it, and he noticed various things about the UFO. I can go on, but I won't take up too much time. But he says at some point he heard a little like a bell thing, next thing you know, he says the fish all of a sudden shot off like rockets. They were terrified.
Huh.
And he says just then he noticed the water getting warmer. Again, this is the heat thing with the UFO. Once that field starts up, you've got it heating everything around it, you know.
Yeah.
So, in the event, these are all effects that these fish kind of sense something. It's either danger, sound, or who knows what. But we don't know enough, and I've just tried to pinpoint the various aspects of what's in all these stories. You know, the trouble is, it's not everything is in the same story. You get one story emphasizes this, another story emphasizes something else.
Yeah.
But when you put them all together, that's when you start finding answers.
Exactly, yeah. I'm sure that you've heard the concept, I guess, elsewhere, but where did you come up with the whole idea of the field theory of, you know, UFO powering and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, I didn't invent the field. There's nothing about that. No, the ball of light thing has been in since I, you know, started reading about UFOs. It's a light phenomenon at night, not during the day, but at night. And I'm sure you're familiar with Paul Hill's book, Unconventional Flying Objects, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a fantastic book. That's my Bible. And he goes into the thing as to why you see it as a ball of light at night and not during the day. Evidently, the sun's rays cancel out the color thing, and so you don't see the field during the daytime. But the field is there. And at night, of course, it's ionizing the air, and it's dark. And so according to the power setting on this thing, is what the color you see. You can go from red, orange, yellow, and then back up, you know, the spectrum. But the field was there all the time. But how the field operated was the mystery to me. You know, I mean, is it a static field? Is it just sitting there like an invisible glass or plastic? No, it's a rotating field. And the reason I found out it was rotating is because of that very thing about how it affects the water. Pushing water up, pushing it down. You don't, if it's a static field, it's not pushing anything. It's just there. But it is pushing. So the field has to be rotating. And the rotating field explains a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. And I like the way you've used the water UFOs to sort of, to help flesh this whole thing out. Now, if someone sees, do you have cases where someone sees a USO underwater, and in that instance, does it appear like that it's inside of a bubble almost?
I've never had it, any of the cases described as such. They say it's there's a light underwater. They look at a glowing ball just like they would at night. Of course, the water's dark, and it's ionizing the water as well as the air. And so you see a ball underneath, not a, a craft. Now, like I said, this other case I had from South America, the guy saw the light under the water, and it was obviously large, and it scared him. And next thing he says, it parked like 200 feet away from him and turned off. It turned the light off, which means they turned the field off. Well, he couldn't have gotten near the UFO if the field was on.
Yeah.
He'd be one of those dead professional divers. But he went up, touched the craft, and so needless to say, the field was not active at the time.
Talk a little bit about that story here with the dead professional divers, because I'm surprised that kind of thing, I don't even ever recall hearing this story, so obviously it must have sort of been overlooked, I guess, in UFO lore, because I don't really know too much about this. What's the story with that?
Well, I'm not that familiar with it off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But as I have there in yellow, 2 days after the crash, two fishermen who were the best divers in the area were found dead and naked on the nearby rocks. Now, they weren't necessarily diving naked. Of course, when you die, your body swells and it rips your clothes off. So that's the reason why probably naked. There were only two who had enough courage to dive where the buoy was. Now, when they're talking about that, that was evidently what was reported as the UFO. They thought it was a buoy, and it wasn't. It was the UFO. They reported to their colleagues that they had seen a disc-shaped object half buried underwater. The ocean water around the disc was terribly hot, so they could not touch it. Again, the heat thing comes back in again. This goes over, on and on and on and on. The heat thing, I got to talk about that. Don Ledger sent me a case I had asked him for. It was in his book, The Maritime Files.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, what intrigued me was two women are coming out of some store or something, and they see a UFO hovering in the rain. And they said above the UFO was a mist. Now, rain is coming vertically down, right?
Yeah.
And it's hitting the UFO field. Now, when it hits that hot field, it's not mist. It's turning to steam. And that's what they're looking at. Mist, steam, fog, all of these are interrelated. You know, they're all white molecules of water. And so whatever you want to call it, it's water, it's steam when it's around a UFO, that's for sure.
Yeah, interesting. That's very interesting. You make a good point here on the page here on waterufo.net that you're not a big proponent of missing ships being blamed on UFOs. So no, that's a good thing.
I hate that thing. The trouble is they try to identify UFOs with everything, you know, it's a bad point. First of all, no one's ever reported a ship hijacked or abducted by a UFO. No one. But just because you have ships missing, then all of a sudden the mystery is, did a UFO abduct it? Well, now they have this thing on History Channel. They had the, the rogue wave, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they said there's no doubt that many ships have been sunk because of the rogue wave. I also have a thing where a commander of a ship way back when said that due to his knowledge of meteor hitting the ocean, and very close to one particular ship, it was covered in the New York Times, as a matter of fact. He says there's no doubt that some of these ships had no warning and suddenly were struck by a meteor and sank immediately. So you've got multiple reasons for ships going missing. It kind of scares you to go on an ocean liner nowadays. But not a UFO. I mean, you got to have some place to store the dang ship. You know, it's an unstable thing outside of water. So why would they want to take one on board a saucer? I have no conception of that. Don't like it at all.
There you go. Yeah. Well, I'm glad we debunked that whole thing. You sound like you're a little puzzled here on the section through the ice, because in some instances the USO or UFO will go in through the ice over a body of water, and some instances it'll be, you know, circular, and other times it'll be all smashed up. So what do you make of the ice factor, I guess you could say, with the USOs?
Okay, well, the UFO field is very hot, as I said. So now when this thing descends vertically to the ice, the field is touching the ice and instantly melting it. So you have a clean hole in the water. But there are several cases in that group where the UFO is actually shooting down across the shoreline and then into the ice from there. Well, now the field is not vertically above the ice. It's coming, pushing its way through the ice. So you've got kinetic energy as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure some of the ice has melted, but the force of the impact is what's breaking up the ice.
And then I guess to stay on the cold part, what do you have here on USOs in the snow, the connection with the snow?
Well, again, it's the melting. This all comes under my heat category because snow is, of course, a different form of water, so as is ice. So it's just yet one more category where you can take a trace from the UFO. I think in some of them in the snow is nothing more than knocking snow off branches. And again, this is not the UFO that's knocking the branches. It's the field that's knocking the branches.
Yeah.
So, basically what you have is a hole in the snow where the field is. And one of my friends had said, Carl, it could be compression. The UFO lands on it and next thing it compresses the snow, which would cause the snow to melt. But the UFOs don't land flat on their craft. They usually put landing gears down. And what you have is not just a tripod landing gear impression. What you have is a 30-foot circle.
Yeah.
That means the entire field is melting the snow. So, again, that's a trace, but it's again, a trace of what? The only thing that can explain it is the field. The field is hot, it melts the snow, and bang, that's what you got. And in many cases, it not only melts the snow, but it melts evaporates the water and causes a singeing of leaves and things underneath it.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, you're talking about a very, very hot field.
Yeah. Is there any situations with, like, I guess you could say, like, snow circles, crop circle type situation with snow? Do you know anything about that?
There was one where snow swirled. I know that. But that's due to the vortex under the UFO. That vortex is the same thing that does the sucking up of water, making a water spout.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is the same thing that lifts cars up on the road. There's a lot of cases where somebody says, we lost control of the car. The steering wheel, you know, we could turn it any direction, but the car kept going straight ahead. We hit the brakes and nothing happened. This is all because the car is actually maybe, it could be a half inch, quarter inch, could be a foot, you know, off the road. You lose all, you can hit the gas pedal, but you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, that's because the craft is physically lifting the UFO, not intentionally necessarily. It passes over the car, and it's the vortex under the UFO that's doing the lifting. I got one case, the Falcon Lake one, where the guy got the radiation burns.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular case, they said it was sucking up leaves, grass, and dirt. You know, and the rock surface was clean in a 15-foot circle. So this vortex is does a lot of damage, but not intentionally. Like I said, it's like prop wash. You know, you get stuff blowing across the field because of the prop wash. But this is a circular field, like a small tornado, if you will, and it's sucking up things below it.
Fascinating. This is fascinating stuff. And I see here also you kind of float the idea that maybe some of these classic sea monster reports might be USOs.
Well, technically, that sea monster, I have one really good one, and that came to me from another researcher. He says, you got to put this one up. And after reading it, I said, yeah, you're absolutely right, I do. The thing that's very important about the big one, that's Puget Sound, July of 1893. Old. That's way before UFOs. But the description is very lengthy, and the thing is, these guys go out, two people go out towards the sea monster, and next thing you know, they're shocked, electrically shocked.
Huh.
Now, they're talking about the sea monster having eight eyes. I don't know if anything that's 150 feet long has eight eyes and can electrocute somebody. Fortunately, these people didn't die. They were shocked, but they were knocked out. They weren't electrocuted. They weren't killed. But the thing is, eight eyes could be windows in the UFO,
yeah,
rather than eyes. And again, 150 feet is the length of this thing. That's, I don't know if, you know, any particular sea monster that, you know, fits that category. But it was beautiful. I had to insert all my little comments in there in a different color so that people knew it was me and not the story. But it was a very long story on that particular sea monster.
Yeah, I think I recall reading that one. It was a really enjoyable piece there.
You must know a lot of ocean songs.
I do. Here's the sea ditty my mother taught me. Love, exciting and new. Come aboard. We're expecting you. And love, life's sweetest reward. Let it flow.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
It flows back to you, the love boat. Soon we'll be making a note.